Welcome, everyone, to News of the Money World. Rupert Carline, Darcy Onagero. Rupert Carline, how you doing? You good?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Very good. You're in a new location this time. School holidays changes everything. So whereabouts are you?
I'm actually down in Masterton, which is awesome. So good to see another part of the country and part of my advisor roadshow of meeting a whole lot of different people, which is awesome.
That's cool. Like, most people think, hey, money people live a pretty boring life, but like you're literally touring with the band. You're performing live.
I put the kids in the car and I kind of go around and it's awesome because I always have an excuse to go somewhere and there are lots of people all over the country I need to see and just I can match and do it all together.
Yeah, that's cool. So this weekend has been amazing because the weekend prior, my head was deep into the Bitcoin space on the podcast talking about the Bitcoin halving, and then roll into the weekend. I look at my price chart of Bitcoin first thing in the morning, as every true Bitcoiner does. That's just kind of what you do. You check it at least once a day. And I saw this horrible vertical line in the wrong direction, and something was up. And this is the cool thing about Bitcoin, is that the price tells us stuff. The price tells us what's going on in markets, especially on the weekend when traditional markets are closed. This is such a black and white thing when you look at decentralized finance, crypto assets. They trade 24/7, but then traditional markets, they stop and they go on a break and they come back. And so if there's events that happen during the weekend, you'll see it in the price action of Bitcoin. And so that was the clue that something wasn't right. So I jumped on Twitter, and in real time, I was watching the response the embassy attack in Syria. So Israel launches an attack on the Iranian embassy. That's as close to one nation state attacking another nation state as you really ever want to get. But of course, it was just a little bit too far. And then it was probably the most widely anticipated response. We had like almost a week waiting for the response or more. And lo and behold, we had over 300 missiles and drones attacked from Iran, Iranian soil, directly to Israeli soil. We saw a missile land straight on an airport. Largely, most of it, of course, was destroyed. I'd be keen to hear your views, but like one view would be, hey, this was obviously saving face. Let's send a swarm of drones, which could easily be swatted out of the sky with the Iron Dome defense system, with our allies and F-16s everywhere. It's like a bit of a joke. That's one theory, and it was just all about saving face. Now it's all over. The other theory is that, hey, this is all about kind of like tipping the iron filings on a bit of paper to try and find out where the magnet is underneath the paper, right? Like, where is the weakness in the Israeli defense system so that maybe the next attack is a bit more successful? I don't know. What are your general views, though, on the whole Middle East conflict at the moment? There's lots that we can go into on this one, so I'd be keen to know kind of what you're thinking about.
Yeah, well, so I actually was at a reception, a phone reception on Friday, Saturday, which was a beautiful place to be. And so kind of was surprised to come back and turn on my phone on Sunday morning and see markets finished down 2% on Friday. And it was a pretty ugly day. So I think to me, this all feels like it's a pretty well calibrated response to the Syrian attack. We had the fact that the US knew about it in advance. The public warnings came out on Friday. It wasn't anything kind of secret, and it was almost done in a way, to my view, my very naive view, of potentially just it's a safe, face-saving operation. They knew they weren't going to do much, so well publicized. They didn't cancel it once they kind of knew that everyone knew about it. So to me, it does stand there. Also, the fact that the Iranians came out yesterday and said, now we see this matter is closed. We don't see any need for any further retaliation or retribution post the attack. So to me, it feels like a nicely balanced response, which sent a signal but didn't actually do anything. The big question now lies into what actually does Benjamin Netanyahu do? He's got a war minister who's already said we need to retaliate. He's got others that are kind of a very right, hard right kind of government there. And I think that's the biggest risk that we now see, right? Are they willing to just leave it alone for what it was and let it move on? And for all of our sakes, from a global economy perspective, we really hope they do, because we're already starting to see the effects of the shipping through the Suez and the Red Sea, where we've already got, in New Zealand, it's kind of, we rely on a lot of imports from that part of the world, and so it's already taking an extra month to 6 weeks for container ships to get down here. The surcharges on the shipping costs are hitting us, and so for us, that means that the kind of goods inflation peaking, again, with a falling exchange rate, not ideal. And then, of course, oil. On Friday, oil peaked above $90 a barrel in anticipation of this strike. And yeah, if it kind of another step up, we are likely to see kind of whether it's $100 or it continues to go up, right? So that's why for us, this does matter. For us, it is that kind of hotspot that we do have to watch pretty closely, because so much of the global economy is kind of centered around that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that, right? Like oil, shipping. The interesting thing, right? So sorry to labor on this. I just find this so fascinating. The interesting thing is gold, the price of gold was kind of showing us something was brewing even before the Israeli attack on that embassy. And I'm not saying that gold knew anything. Gold doesn't know anything. It's just a commodity. But it's weird. It's like hands on a Ouija board. Sometimes the patterns, the price patterns that certain things make can be telling us something, even though it's not obvious, at least in hindsight. Like when you look at it and you reflect on that, gold busted out of its normal range, I think beginning of March, started on a new trajectory, which signaled that maybe that was the first leg in a long-term-ish bullish cycle in the price of gold. So it was kind of predicting what was going on. But the really weird thing with gold is that we're in a high interest rate environment, which actually might be higher for longer. And yeah, we have some central bank buying of gold, but there's a lot of reasons. Like we have a strong dollar, a strong US dollar, a lot of reasons why the price of gold shouldn't be high. And so what do you think? Like there's definitely some predictive powers going on here.
We talked about last week around some of that political stuff that's going on. But I mean, even what else we saw last week, all of a sudden was Yellen and the Americans and China talking about, your manufacturing capacity is too great. We're threatening more sanctions. We're going to retaliate if we see anyone supplying anything to Russia or to Iran. I think gold is reacting to this whole world, which is becoming more and more volatile by the day. But more importantly, the US dollar is becoming less and less of an asset that these countries are willing to own. And even ignoring the Iran Israel thing that happened over the weekend. I mean, last week we had the rhetoric against China stepped up a whole nother notch last week. The conversations around excess manufacturing, state-supported manufacturing, all of those kind of buzzwords. There was something I read this morning about they've found chips in some of the Russian missiles in Ukraine that have come via China. I mean, it is all getting to this kind of the geopolitical, and so it means the US dollar is becoming scarier and scarier for a lot of people to own. And realistically, the only real alternative there is gold. And so I think I haven't seen the flow data, and so I'll have a look at that ahead of next week's conversation. But I suspect once we look at that, we will see a lot of it is going to the likes of these kind of central banks and these other places in the world that are just too scared and are expecting to be sanctioned at some point shortly.
Yeah. Man, so much going on. Okay, so on the topic of Bitcoin, though, like that was one of the things that kind of helped me to wake up and realize something was going on, because that was the only market that was freely able to trade. But there's also something else going on with Bitcoin, which is the much-anticipated day that happens once every 210,000 blocks that are created. It's when we all celebrate that this group of people called the Bitcoin miners get a pay cut. Really weird, but it's significant. And I think the significance is more about its correlatory relationship with the price of Bitcoin rather than the causal relationships that can underpin it. But for those that may or may not understand what the Bitcoin halving is, it happens roughly every 4 years. Happy 420, everyone. That's probably when it's going to happen this year, on the 20th of April. And that's going to be, it's going to be interesting, because every time this happens, we see a dip in the price, a lot of volatility, and then a massive run up in price. So what happens is these miners get their rewards, or they get the amount of Bitcoin that they receive as a reward for mining a successful block, that's chopped in half. And it's currently, I think it's currently 6.25, is going to go down to 3.125 newly minted Bitcoins as the reward for mining a successful block. Forgive me if anybody who's more technical can say it better than that. And so that limited supply with crypto assets that have finite supply like Bitcoin is quite cool, because you can actually study the laws of traditional economics like supply and demand in a very safe and pristine environment. So when the supply gets reduced, that slides further up the demand curve, assuming it's constant, pushes price up. And what's complicating this time around is that we have this Bitcoin ETF, which means that there are these massive conglomerates basically chomping up all of the supply of Bitcoin that's available from exchanges, which creates less supply even more. So then we have this weird geopolitical thing where Bitcoin seems to flip between safe haven and speculative asset occurring, which again correlates to gold. So all of this is combining to create a really interesting time where we could see the price of Bitcoin go through like an intense period of volatility, which means both up and down direction, sideways basically for maybe 6 months. And then from month six to then the subsequent 12 months, maybe we see a significant run up in price. If history repeats, that's the question. Will history repeat?
Yeah. So just on the halving, one thing that's just going through my mind, and I'm not an expert on a huge amount about it, but so this time the block is, you're getting rewarded. Does that mean, so this time it's been 4 years, I think, since the last halving?
Yeah.
So is the assumption that the next one will be 8 years until the next halving, because we're saying it's the same amount of Bitcoin issued, but it's just issued at a much slower rate?
No. So it happens every, it's based on transactions. So it's 210,000 transactions. And so that's a constant that's programmed in. And so it just happens to be that it's more or less on 4 years. So that's it's not like that is 100% responsible for the price action of Bitcoin. Like a lot of people say that it is, or it, not 100% that it is, but it is one of the factors that increases the price of Bitcoin. But it's, I think it's also more important to point out that it's highly correlated with other cycles like the US election cycle, like global liquidity. Those are the things that it's correlated with. And so that's why I think it's more important to kind of point out the correlatory relationships rather than the decreasing new causation stuff. Yeah.
Correlation versus causation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. Like, I don't know. Like, I've been talking to a few people, and I will be this week as well, around its significant. And I think its significance. And I think a lot of people are more pointing towards the ETFs as the wild card this time around, just because that is so significant. And we're seeing like massive net inflows still since the launch earlier this year, right?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the other things I've been reading about, talking about the net inflows, is the amount of leverage that's been accompanying those net inflows.
Mm.
Because we don't have it so much here in New Zealand, but in the US, it's very easy to set up what we call margin accounts. And so you'll buy shares and you're able to borrow up to kind of 70-80% of the value of those shares that you purchase against. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the unintended things that no one really foresaw with the Bitcoin ETFs. You're in your Charles Schwab account and you go, cool, I can now get margin. And so there've been a lot of margin and a lot of leverage coming into the system, which sits in behind those ETFs. And I think that's why we're seeing these very, very sharp moves in price. Because let's be honest, it's been trading in that $62,000 to $71,000 range over the better part of the last kind of 3 or 4 weeks. Because whenever there's a small movement, all of a sudden, a whole lot of margin calls, you have a forced selling, more margin calls, and it's kind of, yeah, it's a, it's a pretty funny cycle, and I'd be curious to see whether the retail brokerages in the US can kind of restrict the leverage available on these ETFs, or whether they keep them going. But it is, to my mind, it's a further sign of kind of what we've been talking about, which is the normalization of this financial product. The problem is the normalization with an intense volatility is causing all of these unintended consequences.
Yeah, and it's so the leverage thing is interesting, and I think we like you say, we don't really witness the use of it so much in New Zealand, but it goes in both directions, right? It can cause the price of the underlying commodity shares, whatever, go up significantly. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that would be because short positions, leverage short positions have been liquidated as the price moves higher, which then creates the need to buy the underlying security to close out the trade, right? Is that kind of how it works?
That's the short squeeze. Here it's just as simple as, hey, look, I can go in with $2, well, $1,000 worth of capital. So I'm an average retailer holder, and I go, cool, I'm going to put $1,000 worth of into Bitcoin. Hold on a sec. I can margin that, and rather than my $1,000 can buy me $5,000 worth of Bitcoin versus $1,000. And so it just means on the way up, when everyone gets really confident, you can come at it with a wall of money and a wall of buying, kind of what can be anywhere between 5 and 10 times what the underlying investment is. And that's the key thing. Luckily, well, I guess it is also probably happening as well, to be honest, the short squeeze. Because again, back into now we're talking traditional financial products. The GameStop story last year, which we all remember, or 2 years ago, which we remember so well, and watch the Netflix program on it if you haven't. But again, that was kind of what you described, Darcy, where the short sellers, the hedge funds, pitch kind of sold as much as they can. And then as you slowly push the price up, it turned into a kind of a revolving cycle. And I suspect there was a little bit of that happening in the Bitcoin world as well. And will continue to happen. Because, yeah, as I said before, all of a sudden, you've got all of these product structures which have been built for the traditional financial markets, which are now being able to be applied because of the ETFs.
It's cool, eh? It's cool understanding all this sort of stuff. Bitcoin is such a great gateway drug to become a better investor in everything. It's because again, it's simple. You can look, kind of understand some of the things in a safe, contained sandpit before you apply it to traditional investments, which are all goose to hell and hard to predict, right? So.
But it is awesome that there's kind of the mixing, right? And it's yeah, it's I find it fascinating where it's tradition that they will become the same thing.
Potentially.
And
So,
you're starting to see that happen really fast right now.
And like onto that mixing thing, I was on social media a lot this weekend, just trying to watch what was going on as it was unfolding. And at the same time, I was seeing a lot of comments from other people, a lot of questions being asked. Like one of them was a call out for any financial advice because someone was just concerned. They were concerned about what this volatility in the geopolitical space means to the volatility of their investment portfolio. And they were wondering if they should get out of their growth fund and move into something safer. And so, yeah, like it's a really important conversation to have, like really important. Anybody in our space needs to be having this conversation all the time, especially when we were reminded of March 2020, what happens when you try to be smart and predict what happens. Sometimes you'll get it right, a lot of times you'll get it wrong. So when we think about our investment portfolio, chances are that collection of investments called a portfolio will have things like cash, fixed interest, shares, property, infrastructure, all sandwiched in there. And they all kind of respond differently to things like the price of oil, interest rates, inflation data, and geopolitical concerns. There's all sorts of stuff. Now, when there's a lot of things that are kind of impacting those other things like rates and oil and geopolitical stuff and inflation data, when that's all, you kind of have to understand all of the things and weight them accordingly, and then factor in how central bankers and how nation states will respond to this as well. And it's very, very complicated to predict what will happen to your portfolio. So if you're in a growth strategy and you're trying to outsmart everything else to position yourself, kind of like changing lanes to get there faster, that's really hard when you have basically the entire world doing the same thing. If you actually outsmart it, well done. Good luck. And it is luck, probably, right? Like, what should investors do if they are trying to kind of look out there and figure out what they should do? Like, I'll let you answer this question. It's a pretty easy answer.
It's a nice layout. Thank you, Dusty. Look, nothing. Short answer is, if anything we've been shown over the last 2 years is predicting markets is extremely difficult. Think back 12 months ago where we were all sitting there going, we're about to hit recession. Recession is coming. It was all pretty scary. Everyone was thinking the stock market would fall another 20-30%.
Yeah.
12 months later, stock market's actually risen 25%, not in New Zealand, but everywhere else in the world. And so, again, we're in this kind of supposed precipice moment where we're going oil, Middle East, kind of recession in Europe, inflation higher. Again, another precipice moment. But I think be very, very, very careful about trying to trade on those precipices and take advantage of it, because it could easily go either way. And what we've learned over the last 12 months is, it does move pretty quickly when it does go, but it can happen. So strong advice is make sure you've got your risks, your appropriate risk tolerance, your time horizon, understand what you're investing for, and just stick with that strategy.
Yeah.
My favorite saying is, don't make long-term decisions based on short-term information. Yeah. And if you're going to react today to what happened on Friday, that is exactly what you're doing.
Awesome. And the only thing I would add to that, if I may, is just like, if you are concerned about these events and how it might impact your investments, that's great. That's like a gateway to more learning about how markets work. And yeah, like maybe with a small part of your portfolio, you position it, again, long-term thinking, but maybe with a small part of your portfolio, you position it according to those long-term things that maybe kind of like your zombie apocalypse hedges, which is what I often refer to them as. Like if you really believe that things are going to go down that path, what type of investments could you make today that don't cost you the earth to own, which may perform well during those times, that might offset some of the losses that you incur in your other one? Again, everybody's situation is different. If you have 5 years before you're spending the money, don't even think about any of this stuff, but we're talking 20, 30 years down the line. So there's no right or wrong answer with investing, but I think the general rule we should follow, because it's generally true, generally all the time, which is to set and forget, set your strategy thinking long-term and don't respond to short-term things like you're saying, right? Even though that's what we talk about. So one of the things
it's important to be aware, but it's also important to not react. And look, and the other truth is, and this is a bit that I think very few people realize, is professional money managers, even though they'll follow all of the stuff and they'll do a lot of it, actually 80-90% of their portfolio is pretty long-term and consistent. And then they might make small trades that sit around the outside. So in the past, we've spent a little bit of time talking about core satellite. And actually, that is how a professional mutual fund works, a professional fund, QSAT fund works, where you've got a core portfolio and then some small tweaks around the edges. Because actually, winning in money management is all about fighting for an extra 0.25% here, an extra 0.5% here. Mm-hmm. The moment you try and fight for that extra 5 or 10%, you've lost, because you might win every now and then. But more often than not, you'll lose.
Wise words. And if you don't believe that, just give it a go and you'll see that is true after a long time.
The ultimate example is when I look at the QSaver league tables from last year, where some of the more active managers last year have all underperformed because they predicted the recession that never turned up. Yes. Whereas the more passive guys did really well last year. And that's, again, following that strategy of they've just stayed invested through the entire cycle.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Now, so we will pick on just one of these things before we finish up, one of these variables that does impact the value of our portfolios, therefore makes us feel either optimistic or pessimistic about the future. And that's this battle of inflation that central banks around the world have been forced to fight, almost like unpreparedly so, from a situation which I would refer to as a generalized policy error with all central banks from March 2020, understandable perhaps. It's still an error. They basically created the inflation that now we have to fight globally. Not a good time to be having another battle, in my view. But this inflation stuff is connected to recessions, because in between inflation and recession is the interest rate lever. US and in Europe, we're seeing stubbornly high inflation and deteriorating economic circumstances. Rupert, I want to know how you are, like, how do you interpret this at the moment? Because it feels like we're in a new environment where it's higher for longer. Correct me if I'm wrong. What's your view there?
I think you are right. I think, though, again, long-term decisions on short-term information. So we've gone one print of inflation data last week, which, of course, CPI came in about materially higher than expectation. When they unpicked that data, they could see pretty clearly that actually it was driven by shelter costs. The US has got a weird kind of definition of that, which I'm not even going to try and get into. Insurance and a few other kind of long-term lags and long-term variables. And so I think, again, we do run the risk of we just need to kind of wait and see through. I've been consistently saying I do think inflation is going to be with us for longer, and it is going to be harder to get that final kind of piece set down than we have anticipated. Mm-hmm. Central banks do seem to have warmed to that idea, and central banks are saying, actually, rather than having to hit 2%, we're now happy to be somewhere in that 2 to 3% range as well. So they've also moved the goalposts, which I do think is actually a good kind of outcome as well. But it is really interesting, right? Because if we believe 2 to 3% is kind of where we're going to last, where we're going to finish the cycle in terms of inflation, it also means that kind of we also need a premium on inflation because we want a real return. People talk about that being 2%. So actually, is the new kind of normal interest rate, should it actually be kind of somewhere in that 4 to 5%? Everything that I read and everything that I'm seeing is starting to kind of say, yeah, it probably should be. That kind of, that is the new normal and the new neutral interest rate, which is actually still lower than where it was 25 years ago, which, so it's a kind of an interesting piece. So I think we are, so part of kind of, that's where I'm a little bit in two minds. One is I do think inflation is stickier. I think it is going to be a bit higher. I think where there's no way, the kind of the neutral interest rate is higher than where we had anticipated. The flip side, though, is I think we are starting to see economies around the world turn. So New Zealand, we're in recession. We talked about that a lot before. There was some commentary on the JP Morgan results from kind of late last week, which was really interesting, where Jamie Dimon talked about they've got, so net interest margin is what you earn when you're a bank. So that's the difference between what you pay for deposits and all your funding and what you earn when you lend it all out to everyone else. And for the first time in about five or six kind of quarters, they've had, or six halves, they've had declining net interest margin. And he attributed that to the fact that retail deposits are kind of flowing out very fast right now, and they're relying on wholesale money, which is more expensive. And so a lot of the growth and a lot of the economic miracle that we've been talking about for the last 12, 18 months has been driven by excess savings in the US. And we're starting to all of a sudden see some signs that maybe this isn't quite so. We look in kind of New Zealand, where in the last probably couple of weeks, I think I saw an article, we've tallied up kind of 10, 15,000 job losses and redundancies. The US, we've got manufacturing indices kind of starting to fall pretty dramatically. And so, yeah, part of me goes, I think inflation is going to be harder to tame, particularly with what we're seeing in the Middle East and kind of $90 to $100 oil, but we are also starting to see growth kind of come back, and it is going to be an interesting kind of period. I think, again, I'm going to repeat this because I think I'm still right. My expectation is that we will see some interest rate relief by the end of the year, particularly in New Zealand. The question is how much, and that's what.
Oh, sorry, you just cut out there a little bit, Rupert. Can you say that again? You said.
Really long way of saying, I think we will see interest rate relief, probably not as much as people are expecting, and it's probably going to be Q4 before we see it. But, yeah, interest rates are definitely not going as low as we would like. And are they going to fall by 50, maybe 100 points? But I'd be surprised.
Right. Okay, so here's the big question I have, and I don't know if this is the right way to phrase it. Markets have gone ballistic over the last 12 to 18 months, but interest rate expectations have changed? Is that because all excess savings have basically been gobbled up? Well, looks like we have lost Rupert, but that was pretty much the end of the show anyway. There's a lot more probably to unpack around the excess savings that we've seen deployed effectively. Maybe that's what's buoyed markets over the last 12 to 18 months. That'll be interesting to unpack. Maybe next week, maybe other stuff as well. But if you're still watching, and thank you for joining us in this episode of News in the Money World, and we'll catch you next week.